Children podcast brought to you by the Children and Youth Department of the Salvation Army in the United Kingdom and Ireland. I'm Jo Taylor, and in each episode I'll be inviting a guest to take a hypothetical hike with me as we find out about their real life journey to this point. Along the way they'll make four choices and answer four questions, and in this episode our guest is Major Nick Coke. Nick is a Salvation Army officer and is currently serving as the Territorial Coordinator for Justice and Reconciliation. Nick's been an officer for nearly 24 years, serving primarily as a core church officer, but has also held additional appointments in our divisional headquarters, our William Booth College, and our territorial headquarters, where he led the Salvation Army's work with refugees and asylum seekers. He's married to Kerry and they have two children. Nick's also an avid reader and loves nothing more than curling up with a good book or enjoying listening to an album from his ever-growing record collection. And we'll head to that conversation in just a second, but I wanted to take a minute to mention something here that I normally save for the end. And if you're anything like me, you might not always make it to the blurby bit after the proper conversation, and it seems a shame that you might be missing out. Do you know that we produce a set of sketch notes to accompany every episode? They're so brilliant and I find them super helpful for reflecting in a different way and highlighting bits I've forgotten or skipped over. If you'd like a feast for your eyes as well as your ears, you can find the link to the sketch notes in the show notes. So now let's get to our hike and the wisdom that Nick has to share with us. So, Nick, welcome. It's so good to have you here. As you know, we ask every guest to make four choices and answer four questions as we travel together. So we're going to start off with a bit of scene setting and we'll go straight in with your first two choices. The first of which is, can you tell me where we're walking today?
Brilliant. So we're walking along the St Cuthbert's Way, which is a path on the borders between England and Scotland. And it's a walk I actually did last year. It's beautiful walk along, and you end up on Lindisfarne, Holy Island. So, beautiful scenery, seaside and hills.
Yeah, it is a beautiful part of the country, I think. One of those places that feels different somehow.
Yeah, there's a sort of people talk about thin spaces between heaven and earth. I did get a sense of that as I walked along that path last year. So I want to go back. That's why I want to walk there today.
And walking onto Lindisfarne, onto Holy Island, did you do that? Did you walk on across the causeway, muddy feet and all?
I absolutely did, and that was actually the best bit of the whole thing. Following this ancient pathway, pilgrim pathway, taking off your boots. My feet were a bit wrecked and tired of blisters and things.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And it was just a lovely in every way, and the weather was absolutely amazing as well that day. So everything about it just felt holy.
Yeah, beautiful. That's a great place to walk in. I'm excited that I can imagine being there with you, knowing the tail end of that walk a little bit. So that's great. And your second choice is who's coming with us. You can choose three fellow travellers, one living, one dead, and one fictional.
Okay, so for the living companion, I've chosen a poet because I think you need a poet with you as you're walking along. So it's no accident that I think it's in Dante's Divine Comedy, it's the poet Virgil who sort of guides him along this journey. And so I have this feeling that a poet's going to be good for the journey. So I've chosen a British poet. She's called Alice Oswald. And that's probably quite a niche choice. People might not have heard of her.
Yeah, so tell us a bit about her.
Well, she's the Oxford Professor of Poetry, but the thing that I really love about her poetry is that it's nature poetry, but what she does is she really gets down to incredible detail in her poems. So, for example, she writes a poem about shadow, your own shadow as you're walking along. She writes another, there's another poem about a drop of dew that is on a blade of grass. And it's this sort of sense of attention to detail that I love. And it, she's just... uses that as a way to go really deep. It's soul, life-giving stuff in her poetry. So I think she would, if, as we're walking along, I think she would point out lots of interesting things and be able to use language that's going to help us to really get into it.
Oh, she sounds excellent. And I think when I think of poets, I often think of people who maybe do kind of more big picture scene setting. So actually someone who does that detailed stuff, who really looks kind of down and around, sounds like it could be a really beautiful perspective. I'm interested to have a look at some of her work. So thank you for introducing her to us. And your next guest.
Yeah, so this is somebody who has... is dead. And I think given we're doing St. Cuthbert's Way, I think we need St. Cuthbert himself to come with us.
Yeah.
So he's a fascinating character. He was a seventh century priest and monk. And he is really known for his contemplative kind of approach to his faith. So he was a hermit for many, many years. And he lived on Lindisfarne for a while in the monastery there. But he thought it was too busy in the monastery, too many people around on an island. So he decided to take himself off to a smaller island where there absolutely was nothing but seabirds. And so he lived there as a hermit. But then he got made bishop for Northumbria. So they came and dragged him out of his hermitage and took him back to the mainland. And he became this incredible bishop who did extraordinary things. And so the path of the St. Cuthbert's Way really follows the sort of area he was ministering in. So I think he would be able to tell us some incredible stories about what happened in these different places as we're walking along. So that's why I think he would be a good person to have on this walk.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that that kind of inner call and inner desire for solitude and contemplation. But then when the call comes to serve, like he did and served well.
Exactly. I mean, his after he died, his where he was buried became a massive pilgrimage place. So people, thousands of people over many years came to visit where he was buried. He's just very well known in that part of the world as well.
Yeah. Great shout. And your final, our final companion for our walks.
Yeah, so fictional character. So I'm going to go with Gandalf from Lord of the Rings. Now, some people might have seen the films, which I haven't loved. I also loved the book, so I read it when I was quite young. And I've read it a number of times because I loved it so much. But Gandalf is just this extraordinary character in the book. He's wise, he's funny, he's brave. And I think that kind of person you want with you on a long walk. I also love the fact he has a massive long pipe and blows the smoke rings.
Which he's got some serious skills there, haven't he?
Exactly. Doesn't even need any magic for that. So I think that could be quite entertaining. And that beard as well. I mean, it's an amazing thing. So Gandalf, I think, would be a great companion.
Yeah, for so many reasons, I think Gandalf would be great. And to see someone do that thing with a pipe in real life, I feel like would be quite extraordinary. excellent. So now we know where we are and who's with us, we can move on to the first of our questions. So, Nick, how do you face change?
So I've had a lot of change over my life. My father moved around a lot with work, so the family would move from time to time. My dad's he's retired now, but he was a vicar in the Church of England. So often we would, as children, I can remember having a few years, and then we'd sort of move house to a different place, and often it was quite a long way from where we had been. So change is, for me, has just become part and parcel of life, and now I'm a Salvation Army officer myself, and I've moved several times as an adult to different places in the country. So how do I face change in those circumstances? For me, it's been about, well, what am I rooted in? What doesn't change, even though you might be in a different location? What is actually the same and remains the same? So I think this is really important when it comes to change, is this idea of having deep roots into things that matter and the things that can hold you, even when change is a bit tricky and a bit difficult.
So what have those roots look like for you?
So I would say, I mean, it's interesting how the Bible actually talks a little bit about this sort of stuff. So as Paul writes in a couple of the different letters to the different churches about being rooted and established in Christ. And for me, I think that's important, that my roots are in God and in Jesus and my relationship with Jesus. And so I think you... That doesn't come overnight. That comes over a long, long time, and investing in that and being willing to give time to developing and growing your roots into Christ. And I think when change then hits you, if you've got those in place, then that holds you in an incredible stead. I often think about trees. So I actually love trees, and it sounds a bit strange. I don't hug trees, but I do like to kind of go and just spend time sitting under a tree. And often I find that trees are great sort of metaphors for how we can be rooted in how they can withstand these strong winds, and how they bend in the wind, but they're able to stay standing because they have these roots that go down deep into the earth. So I think the things I'm rooted in are things like family make a difference, other relationships that I have with different friends, and also the community I'm living in, I think, is important. Like we can't just live in sort of isolation. When we put our roots down, it's amongst people and place. And so I think these are the sort of roots that help us when big changes come along and shake us a bit with the winds of change. We're able to stay standing because we've got those roots down.
I don't know if you have an answer to this, because I don't know if it's even been your experience, but I kind of recognise it, that thing of those sort of big things that root us and are our kind of foundation. But also aware that sometimes there's sort of change and flux even in those. And even if God doesn't change, like our understanding of who God is and what that means might. And I wonder what happens then, like if the things that we considered foundational, then our understanding of those starts to shift and change a little bit.
Well, I mean, that absolutely happens all the time. It certainly has for me throughout my life. I mean, and I think it's being open to that. Actually, is it a scary thing, change, or is it actually something to be open and excited about? I think that change can make us feel a bit unsettled and feel a little bit like sort of off balance in some way, but the new opportunities that come with it definitely can outweigh that sense. And I mean, life would be pretty boring without change. So those big things, I mean, how do I think about what it actually means to be rooted in God, for example? I mean, that's not a static thing. That's something that's changing all the time, and something we God leads us into, I think, and we and actually change, helps to change us, and hopefully for the better.
I think that's helpful, and I think recognizing there's elements of not sameness, but elements of maybe consistency, but also elements that are in flux, and understanding that his is fixed when everything else is changing. Like, our understanding of that is going to shift slightly, isn't it?
Definitely. I mean, I don't think we could cope with everything changing all the time. There has to be those constants that do remain the same. I often think of it as sort of resilience, and the definition of resilience as being a bit like elastic. You can sort of bend and then it comes back into position, and I think that's what change does, that a bit like a tree in the wind will sort of, you know, bend and then it sort of comes back. And I think that resilience is built by these deep roots you have, that you invest in your life, but they allow you to bend and shift and change the way you think about things because you have them. That means you're learning.
Yeah, I think about building in an earthquake zone. Like, actually, those buildings that fall down are the ones where the foundations are entirely rigid. And if your foundations, no matter how deep they are, actually rigidity and solidness aren't necessarily in your favour. Whereas actually, if you have a little bit of flex built in, and it's still the foundations, it's still the kind of the basis of what you go up from, but actually there needs to be some room for flex in there. Otherwise, potential for it to come crashing down because of the slightest shift or wobble.
Absolutely. And that's been my experience. I totally agree with that, because being too hard and fast with things can definitely become a problem. And the lack of flexibility, or the lack of being willing to become like elastic, you know, bend a bit. We definitely need that in our lives when change comes along, so that we can adapt into different situations, for sure.
Yeah. Thanks, Nick. That's really helpful. I think I have ideas about like what definitely can't change, and then I'm surprised that those things can, but I'm still able to identify the things that haven't. And there are definitely things that haven't changed and don't change. It's just my understanding of them that does, I think. And I guess some of this helps us move into our next question, that understanding of those foundations and what we're built on. But as we move into question two, and we start thinking about how do you move through suffering?
Yeah, so I would say the experience I've had over my life, for most of my life, I think I've been pretty sheltered from personal suffering. And I feel that's quite a privileged position that I've had. But a couple of years ago, I had an experience that actually changed a lot of that, and that's actually going to shape the way has shaped the way I'm thinking about this question and moving through suffering. So just after lockdown, as we were coming out of the pandemic, I had a medical diagnosis which came as a complete shock, and I actually discovered I had a brain tumour. So from going along in life as someone who hadn't really ever been sick in any meaningful way before, suddenly to have this moment when I found myself at A&E in the middle of the night and being told such serious news, I was really shaken. And that took me into a period, and my family into a period, where there's a lot of uncertainty. We didn't really know what this tumour was like and what it was going to do, and whether there was any how it could be dealt with and all of that stuff. And I've had a couple of years worth of medical treatment, and I've come through that and feeling really good, which is miraculous. But I learned an awful lot about suffering, personal suffering, during that time, because suddenly I had no control over something. I think that was really disconcerting. I think there was a sense of having to just accept something that was going on that I couldn't do an awful lot about, and feeling sad about that, and that's okay. And I think that's what one of the ways we move through suffering is that we accept it's a reality in the world, and none of us can get through life without facing it at some point. I think some of the things that that really helped me was just knowing I wasn't on my own. So my family were amazing. Supporting me, my church, my core, Salvation Army Corps, were amazing in supporting us as a family, the doctors and nurses and everyone in the hospital and all of that stuff. And God was present in it. And it, in a strange way, I met God more in this experience than I have when I've not been going through that. Even from the moment that the consultant in the hospital told me what was going on, and that sort of moment of shock, I sensed the presence of God in it, right there in the room. So how do we move through suffering? Well, I think it's being able to accept that there are people around you. I had so many people saying that they were praying for me, and I know that that just felt like they were upholding me in some way. And I think it's being able to rely on others. And I think it's being willing to learn, really, about yourself. So Alice Oswald, the poet I mentioned earlier, she has a collection of poems with the title Falling Awake. And I love that little phrase, falling awake. And I'd say there was that's a pretty good description of how I felt during those couple of years. I felt like I was falling. You know, it was that lack of control. But I was also waking up to something that I hadn't really known or discovered about myself and about God before. So it,
What are some of those things that you learnt about yourself and about God, do you think?
Well, I've learned that God's there in the difficult moments. And it can feel, for, I don't know, for some people, you have these moments of great doubt or God's absence and all of those things, the sort of dark night of the soul kind of experience. That wasn't what I experienced. I felt there was a real sense of God's presence in even in the horribleness of it. So an example of that would be when I was having radiotherapy, I'd go every day to the hospital and have to sit under a sort of radiotherapy machine for 20 minutes while it sort of blasted my brain with some radio waves. And at first it was quite a frightening experience because you were sort of locked down with this mask over your face. But I actually, as time went on, this moment of 20 minutes every day in the hospital became almost a sacramental thing, because I would lie down on this bed, I'd have 20 minutes to, I couldn't move, I couldn't really do anything whilst this was going on, so I was just sort of stuck there. And up on the ceiling, as I looked up, they had a picture of a tree lit up in lights.
Okay.
I've told you about my love for trees. Okay.
Yeah, so,
And it's a rowan tree they had up there. And I would look at this tree and it just set off all sorts of interesting thinking and about what God was doing in this moment. And I actually weirdly started looking forward to this 20 minutes every day. And I know that sounds really strange to say it, but so I think... What was I learning? I think I'm learning that God does unexpected, surprising things in difficult situations. And I was probably shielded from a lot of that when I was going through life without a worry of any sort. I didn't see those kind of things. Those weren't emerging out of what's around me. I was just overlooking, perhaps, what God's doing in very small ways around us all the time. So I would say that was a definite thing that I learned through that experience.
Yeah. I'm just wondering about how any of that experience informed the work you do. So obviously you head up the Salvation Army's justice and reconciliation work, which is a really inspiring job, but also means that you're having to face injustice and where people aren't reconciled. But that is part of your everyday. I wonder if what you learned through that own your own personal time of suffering has impacted how you face some of those, that broader suffering that you see.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting thing to think about. So it's true to say that I would, over my Salvation Army officerships, have spent time with people going through great tragedies and difficulties and suffering in different ways. And I think it's possible to become a little bit hardened sometimes when you're seeing a lot of that. And I think the experience of particularly the loss of control and power in this particular thing that I was going through woke me up to this to notice who is it in our world who is facing the same, that lack of power over their own lives, and to be able to make things happen for themselves in the way they would like it to, and to notice all these people who just don't have that. And I noticed that in the hospital and things like that in a way I'd never seen before. I'd notice it if I was on a bus. I'd suddenly notice it in different ways that I hadn't before. But I think when it comes to justice, we really are often talking about power, actually, because the way I think about power is it's the ability to act, to be able to do something and make choices for yourself. And I do think there are many, many people, definitely across the world and in our communities, who don't have the power to act over the things they would like to. Part of, I would say, the role of the church and Christians and the Salvation Army is to find ways to help people build power so that they can do things for themselves. Not that we do it for them, but they do it for themselves. So I had that in a kind of very personal experience in going through this particular illness. And there were people alongside me who were empowering me to be able to get through that, and to feel a measure of control of what was going on. In a similar way, I think that's the work of justice for in the world for us.
Yeah, it's really helpful. And I know your work in this area is long. It's it's not that just because suddenly, you know, you went through this thing, you decided you should help. I know that you've been someone that has looked to stand alongside those on the margins and looked to amplify the voices of those we don't hear from so often for a long time. But I think we do often see things slightly differently when we live moments and are able to understand things different in ways because of an experience of something that helps us share in that a little bit.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Yeah, that's all really helpful. I think the noticing piece is so important. Noticing what's going on with us and then noticing what is happening with others, I think, like just taking time to look and be present in a space and whatever that looks like, and it's really, really powerful. So thanks for that reminder. We get to make another choice now. I'd imagine there'll be lots to say. I'm thinking with the people that we're with, I think it feels like there'll be a fair amount of silent contemplation going on as we travel. For those of us that don't do so well with silence, maybe for us to share in together too, get to think about what we would be listening to as we hike. what's on the playlist.
Okay, so I actually have a question about this, Jo. So,
okay.
I love listening to music, and mm-hmm. I have a massive record collection.
Okay.
So are we allowed to listen to this music on a portable record player that we've come
on? What, like on a backpack or something?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I am the daughter of a man who thinks that things definitely sound better on vinyl. So I can appreciate that. And if we can find a way of making it work, and seeing as the whole thing's hypothetical anyway, let's say yes, we can definitely do that.
Excellent. Okay, so I brought a few records along for the journey.
Excellent.
I have my portable, battery charged record player, so it definitely could work. And I've got three particular bits of music that I think I would definitely want on my playlist. So the first one, I'm a massive fan of Bob Dylan, so that's the first singer. Now I know some
another poet.
That's the thing. So his voice, people can take and leave his voice, but his lyrics are magnificent, and he didn't win the Nobel Prize for Literature for nothing. So I think the Bob Dylan's lyrics would kind of carry us along, and there's plenty of justice in there as well in his lyrics, which I quite enjoy. I also think we're going to need a sort of sense of, on a long walk, a sense of energising. Mm-hmm. And I love soul music, and I'm a big fan of particularly of Curtis Mayfield, the American sort of soul funk singer from the 70s. And so I think he's got a record called There's No Place Like America Today, which is full of justice and that kind of stuff, but it's really upbeat and lovely and sounds great on vinyl. And just to show that I'm also up to date, I don't just like old guys. there's a group of a band at the moment called The Young Fathers. They're from Scotland, from Edinburgh, and they're a hip hop band. And I love their album that came out last year. And I particularly, what I love about one of their tracks is they've got this line in it which I think is worthy of Shakespeare, really. They say in one of their songs, "Breathe in like a lion, breathe out like a lamb."
Oh wow.
And I think that is so deep. A great motto for life, and so it takes me straight to the Book of Revelation, the lion, the lamb, and all that stuff. And I think so I think the Young Fathers, who are full of energy themselves, and their music is just brilliant, I think they would be an excellent company us on our walk and on our playlist.
I haven't heard of them. I'm obviously not as cool as you, Nick, but I'm saying I'm not as cool as you, so I haven't heard of them. But for that lyric alone, I'm definitely going to go and have a little look. Also love a bit of hip hop. I'm really liking the sound of this playlist.
I mean, I come up with a little more, but
I think it's a good job. It's such a long walk.
And the other thing is, I love listening to music in albums rather than tracks. So if I have records, you get to listen to the whole thing, really.
Yeah, well, I've been challenged about this recently because I, in this Spotify age, I'd become a playlist girl, really. And would add kind of songs as I heard them to a playlist, and songs were fed to me just kind of go through these sort of curated playlists. And I've been challenged recently by one of our terrainees, in fact, to listen to albums. So I've been doing that, been making a real point. If I hear a song that I like, instead of just adding that to my liked songs, I am making time that week to listen to an album, and every week at least listening to one new album. That's my from start to finish. So that's a little practice that I've picked up. Nice. I think I'm going to make The Young Fathers my album of the week.
Heavy is the name of the album. So make a note of that.
I am. I'm going to check that out. And I'll let you know what I think. But I'm excited to discover someone new. And Bob Dylan, Curtis Mayfield, not new, but brilliant. So that's great. And yeah, all of that leads us really nicely onto our next question, because I'm feeling really good. Nick, how do you receive joy?
Well, it's, I think relationships, I think, is a key thing for me. And recognizing which relationships you have and with what. So obvious ones of family and friends and work colleagues and people around us like that. But I like to think of this a little bit bigger, I guess. So I think relationship with God is obvious too, that's a key to joy. But I think we discover that God, a relationship with God, through all these other relationships that we have in our lives. I think relationship with creation, for example, is really, really important. I've talked about the trees already. I think also recognizing who is around us and what is around us at all times is a way to receive joy. So an example of that, so there's a wonderful song by spoken word artist Kay Tempest. I don't know whether you know her work. They talk about, in this particular spoken word song, about standing at a train station in a feeling pretty dreadful about things, and then suddenly finding joy in people's faces. And I spend quite a lot of time standing at train stations, so getting in and out of the office, and it can feel a pretty depressing place, to be honest. You're sort of standing there, the weather could be bad, it's cold, you're waiting for a train, it's late, etc., and it's all so busy. But that idea of just noticing people's faces around, in this piece it talks about the beauty in people's faces, and I just suddenly thought, oh, that's a interesting exercise to try. So without looking strange and sort of staring at people, a way to sort of notice that kind of thing. And I think it really does work in terms of finding joy where you're not expecting it. Another way I've thought about this is, so it's the poet Mary Oliver, who I also love. She's beautiful poet, but she has this thing where she says, instructions for living a life: pay attention, be astonished, tell about it. And I love that. So this idea of paying attention to the world around you, and be prepared to be astonished, and sharing that with the world. That's how we receive joy, but also how we give joy to others. And again, she's a poet, who nature poet, really, so points out that there's stuff going on around us all the time, it's everywhere, and we so easily miss it if we're not even looking. So I'm big into that kind of stuff. And if someone wanted to think about it in a sort of a religious tradition, there's a French monk from the 18th century who wrote about something called the sacrament of the present moment. And I think that's what it is. It's this idea that in every single moment, anything could happen that becomes sacramental. In other words, you meet the divine, you meet God in that moment. That could be in the middle of a conversation, that could be while you're eating a meal, that could be while you're on the train, it could be whatever it is, being open to every moment being sacramental. And that's how I think we receive joy. I think being open to that, and I've tried to practice that, because I think it's a practice. I don't think it's something that necessarily comes to us intuitively. We have to work at it and become more attentive to what's going on around us.
You noticed a difference in doing that? Do you think you feel like, as well as, so like more joyful, but also do you feel more other things as well?
Yeah, definitely. So I think it's a way of lifting you out of your own headspace. So I can spend a whole load of time just sort of wandering along, and I'm thinking about all sorts of different things. But I think that can become very self-indulgent, where we're sort of mulling over the things of our lives, whether that's good or bad. But I think it just takes the view out of yourself for a moment onto something else.
Mm.
And I think we need that. I think that's part of what contemplation is. The mystics all talk about this thing called contemplation, which I think most of us think is quite hard to do because we're all so busy. But the beauty of this idea is that it's actually, you can do it in the busyness. It's not something you have to be in solitude. You don't actually have to be on the St. Cuthbert's Way to do this. You could do it wherever you are at any point. And I think it's that opportunity just to be curious about the world and to look for what might be round the corner. And that does shape us, I think, and it helps to become, I think, more humble about the world. It's not all, everything doesn't revolve around us. I think, and that's a great quality we should try and develop in ourselves. And I think it also helps us to notice where the other people are important, actually, and things that they're saying and doing. And that's, again, takes the focus off us. And it helps us to feel a bit freer from, it's all about us and what we do. We can find a freedom in noticing other things that are going on around us.
Yeah. There's so much goodness that isn't ours, like that we don't own and haven't created or aren't even a part of, but there is joy and wonder and goodness just around all of the time.
That's exactly it. I was thinking about the story of Moses and the burning bush, and this idea that he's out with the sheep in the desert and sees this bush that's on fire, and he goes over and God speaks to him out of this bush. But I just wonder whether there'd been many burning bushes before the one he noticed that he just didn't notice. I mean, he's literally in a desert. I mean, I think burning bushes are probably quite common in
quite
a desert environment. But he goes over and he sort of it says in the Bible that he notices it. He goes over and takes a look. It's that active kind of going over and looking. Yeah. And I think that's...
Allowing himself to be interrupted in what he's doing and...
Yeah, I definitely think it's that. So, are we open to that noticing? I think that if we really want to receive joy, I think that's sort of some of the way it happens.
So you said about Mary Oliver, and her third thing was, like, tell others about it. Like, do you do that? And what difference does that make?
So I try to. I don't always do it. I'm not an amazing storyteller, and sometimes these things are quite small things. But I think it. Yeah, I do talk about things that I notice and tell others about it. We have this thing in the Christian church about evangelism and talking about God and talking about Jesus, and I think this is really part of what that is. It's not a formulaic sort of thing. We're going and just sharing about what we see around us and where we see God at work in the world, and I think that's what she's sort of getting at. But I think you talk about things. The second part she says be astonished. So I think it. You have to be open to, well, what is this astonishment that you're noticing that you want to talk about? That's the thing. I think if it's just boring, mundane things, I think telling people about it could be a bit boring. But I think
maybe that's my problem. I'm not very good at knowing what the difference is.
Well, I'm sure that's true for us. But I think being able to notice something that is worth talking about it is where it gets interesting, and I think this Jesus was a master at this. I think that's where all his parables come from, where he he noticed everyday life, and then he sort of used that as a way of storytelling, because he'd seen stuff going on in the world.
Yeah.
I think I'd like to be a bit more like that, where, I mean, my stories were a bit more Jesus-like, where they sort of could draw on that everyday astonishment and share something of the of just the good news of God in the world and at work in the world.
Yeah, it's really great. I think there have been some really useful trends recently as we've talked more about kind of keeping our minds healthy and building resilience, and it feels like the language of gratitude has become much more widespread. A lot of people trying to take time to be grateful for things. But I wonder if that little shift, just kind of noticing, makes it even more powerful, because in gratitude, like, you are, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with being grateful, I think it's a really important practice, but it does tend to be about your own experience of the thing that you're grateful for because it happened to you, whereas just noticing what is going on around you is an invitation to celebrate more of the goodness in the world.
Yeah.
Generally.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the idea of curiosity is important in this. And I know there's been some studies and things around that. Sort of, are we curious people? Do we want to sort of know what's going on? I think that's a good and healthy spiritual practice, to be curious about things. Because that's where we sort of lift ourselves out of our own world a bit, to enter someone else's, or to see things we wouldn't normally notice. So I think that's something that I've tried to develop in myself a little bit more. Am I curious in wanting to know what somebody's actually saying when they're talking to me? I can listen to it and then sort of walk away. But actually having a sense of curiosity, I think, helps us into that space.
I'm not good at paying attention. So I think that little reminder to pay attention and be astonished, I think it's just so easy to just meander through, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much that is astonishing when you take the time to look.
Absolutely.
I'm going to do that. And I'll tell you all about it, Nick, next time.
Excellent.
We talk, I'll come with a list.
I'd love to hear it. I'll be curious about it.
Excellent, great. Sam, well, we can move on to our final choice. I'm good at paying attention at this point, because this is something that really interests me. A lot of walking. St. Cuthbert's Way is long. Been doing the hard work of contemplating. So what are we taking in the snack bag?
Okay, so I have to confess, I have quite a sweet tooth. So
brilliant. That's excellent. Music to my ears.
Good. So I would definitely pack some Cadbury's fruit and nut.
Oh, less so. But that's okay. It started off really well.
Well, sorry to disappoint you there. Well, this will probably disappoint you even further. Because when we were growing up, my parents used to take us on holiday, and we always went to the Lake District. My parents love walking, so from about age three, I was being dragged up mountains. And one of the few things that would sort of help with some of the walks when I got a bit bored was having Kendall mint cake.
Yes, brilliant.
And
as you started saying Lake District, I was like, he's got to say Kendall mint cake.
And particularly the chocolate covered Kendall mint cake, because that kind of is an even better combination. So yes, that would definitely be in the snack bag. I also love biscuits, I have to say. So my particular favourites are fig rolls. They may not be your thing, but I do love a fig roll.
They have the same issue for me as the fruit. I'm not a raisin fan, so that's where it isn't ideal. But I know a lot of fig roll lovers, so I know that there will be a lot of people, because it's quite a niche choice, but people who love fig rolls really love fig rolls. So I'd imagine you'll have made some people really happy. And the Cadbury's fruit and nut, there's not too many raisins in there, so I can get past that. But the chocolate Kendall mint cake, excellent. And that's what it's designed for. It's for sustaining you on this hike. And
yeah, exactly. So you feel okay eating, even though it's going to be pretty unhealthy, let's be honest.
Yeah.
But it's made for walkers. Yeah. So,
so it must be good for you.
Exactly.
Got pictures of walkers on the people walking on the packet, all the rest of it. So it's a very virtuous snack. So I think it's all good.
Definitely.
That's a great choice. Well, feeling sustained now as we go into our next question. That is a proper quick energy boost. Our final question of the podcast. How do you mature in service?
Yeah, so I've talked a lot about this sort of contemplative stuff in answering the other questions. And I think how we mature in service is combining that with action.
Mm.
So if I think about all the people I admire, people I know, but also sort of more well-known people in history and in particularly in the Christian church through history, they all pretty much fall into the category of what I call mystic activists. So they're people who take seriously the spiritual things of God, but they're people who do something as well. So the idea, and I think Sir Cuthbert, you know, he's a good example of someone who was both a hermit and a bishop out doing this stuff. And I think that's really what I would say is how we mature in service. You need both those things. I think we have a leaning probably towards one of those more than the other. I certainly find myself over different parts of my life feeling much more activist than mystic. So I would much rather sort of go and do something. So an example of that was back in 2015 when there were lots of refugees crossing the channel and the war in Syria was raging, and it was really challenging. I just had this sense of having to go and do something. I don't think I could have just sort of retreated into a prayer space and contemplated it. I had to physically get out and go and do something, and that took me to the jungle in Calais and then some work, the ministry that came out of that. But so I think you also need to go back to the contemplative and it's not a straight either or. All this stuff is mixed up and it flows in and out of each other. But for me, that's how we mature. I think we take time to do things. I think it's an action that breathes life into us. But it's then the reflection and the contemplation upon what we're encountering that helps to root it, to go deeper into us, help us to mature over time. Yeah, so there's this sense of both of these things. And I think, you know, what does it mean to be contemplative? Because I think that's an interesting one. I think it's all those things about silence and spending time with God, but I think it's also great art. I think it's beauty. It could be a view. I think it's poetry, I've mentioned. It could be great music. It could be literature. I think it's all of those things help us to help our souls. And I think if our souls are going deep and maturing, then our action will be more profound and we'll be wiser in the sorts of action that we take and choose to take. So it's a sort of interplay between these two things, I think.
You mentioned that moment of the kind of responding back in 2015 and finding yourself in what was called like the jungle in Calais. Can you think of any more examples of where, like that kind of moment of contemplation, where a moment of study or something that has resonated really deeply inwardly has led you to kind of do something different outwardly?
I mean, I think I'm just going to reflect a little bit more on that moment because I think there was an interesting coming together actually of these two things, which might help to kind of root it a bit more. What I think I'm trying to say. So, actually, when I was in that camp, so there was about 10,000 people living there at the time, in tents. It was not a particularly nice place to be, but right in the middle there was a church that had been built out of bits of wood and bits of rubbish. Had been this actual church. It looked like a church structure, and when you went into it, it had candles lit and icons. It was an Ethiopian Orthodox style church in this sort of shanty town. And it was a really extraordinary thing, because the life outside that space was hectic. It was dangerous for people living there, because it was lawless, that anything could go on there. But you stepped into this space, and this sudden sense of God's presence in amongst this dire space and place was really profound. And it had a regular prayer time, and it actually had somebody looking after it who led the prayers. And I mean, it was quite an amazing thing. And there was some sense of this coming together of action, contemplation. I think it was there that I really felt God saying to me, I'm here, I'm in this place, but you've got work to do.
Yeah.
And I came out of that church, and that experience had changed everything. And I think there's some verses in the book of Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah. He talks about the word of God is like a fire in his bones, and he can't hold it in because it's burning inside. And that's how I felt. That was the best way of explaining how I felt in that moment, that I couldn't hold it in anymore. I had to go. The only way I was going to be able to be sort of happy with myself was to go do something. So there probably are other moments like that, which I can't call right this moment, but I think this is how God works, that we have a profound moment, a profound experience that comes through our contemplation, and we're pushed into the world to go and do something. And I think I think if we really genuinely want to go deeper into God, we want to mature in service, we have to hold these two things together.
What happens when you're frustrated in the doing? Like when you know that there's stuff to be done.
Yeah.
The kind of they're being released to do, or the support to do, or the mechanisms to do don't exist. Like what happens there?
I think we need great patience. If you're feeling energized to do something, though, often that's the last thing you want to hear somebody say. You want it now, don't you? You want to see the difference of something right now, particularly if you're feeling angry about the situation. Mm. And that's often an emotion that comes with injustice that you see. I think that you need others around you to talk to about this, and to work together. And I think you have to recognise the small victories, as it were, along the way. So, and that can include a change in yourself, or a change in somebody else towards a certain issue. I mean, I as part of my role for the Salvation Army, I lead our public affairs team. Mm. And so we're engaging with Parliament and politicians, and we have particular campaigns that we're working on around homelessness and modern slavery and different issues related to poverty. And you could argue that a lot of that work, you're not, what are you actually achieving? Mm. Are politicians making new laws because of what we say? Often that doesn't happen, but does that mean that we shouldn't do the work? I don't think so. I think there's, you're part of the big conversation around these things. You're influencing in different ways. You're giving opportunity and voice to people who wouldn't otherwise have a voice about some of these matters. And okay, you might not win the political campaign, but you certainly are changing culture and changing thinking. And I think that's really, really, really important to hang on to, particularly in the work of justice seeking, which is something I'm very passionate about. So I think it's easy to think, oh, we can't do anything, or what's the point, or why bother with politics because nothing changes. Well, actually, it does change. It changes because of a lot of different things all coming together and different voices and building in a kind of movement way. And we all just have to play our part and not give up and encourage each other to do it, even when it feels difficult.
I think that's really helpful. I think about your role and and how it, like, you must just be constantly holding intention that balance of the privilege it is to do what you do, and the, yeah, that kind of that doing something, and then the frustration of, like, constantly being aware of how much more there is to do. And I think recognizing that it all counts is really helpful and really important.
Yeah. And I mean, just to, I think it's worth saying that, I mean, we have a general election this year in the UK is coming, and it would be very easy for all of us who are eligible to vote to say, well, you know, is there a point in voting? Does my vote count? Yeah. I hear people saying those kind of things. It absolutely does matter. Every single one of us have need to get out and vote. So, yeah. Even if we don't really know, well, who to vote for, let's try and find out, and let's use that opportunity. I think sometimes we forget that we have these opportunities and that they're privileges. There are some people in the country who won't be allowed to vote for various reasons, but we do. And so I think it's often the smaller things, the small actions, actually, when done collectively, make the biggest difference. So that going back to Mary Oliver's sort of tell about it, well, I think maybe that's part of this as well. say what you're doing and tell people what you care about, what's moving you to want to go and do something and make change in. Even that is part of this sort of action into the world that I think we're called into.
Yeah, it's a really helpful reminder, I think, because of the way our voting system works. I think there have only been a couple of occasions in my life where my vote has resulted in, like, where I've put my vote in the box of the winning side, basically. So it would be really easy to think, like, I've been voting for all of these years and it's never counted. But I think there's something so powerful about showing up, and I think there's something really powerful about modelling showing up. And as, like, again, like, part of a family where we always voted, and so I had it modelled to me, the kind of the importance of that, and know that I still see it as important because of the way it was modelled. And so just modelling showing up can have impacts on generations. Yeah. There's so much more than just what happens once you've put your tick in the box before and after. It's a really helpful reminder. Encourage people as well to speak to those that are disenfranchised for whatever reason. I feel like I wouldn't be doing my job as a youth worker if I didn't. So let's speak to those disenfranchised young people who are looking at the world and are really hungry to make a difference and can't in that way. Like, how can we help?
Yeah.
You talked about, like, look at who's got power and who hasn't, and the power that we do have. How can we use, as voters, how can we use the power that we've got as voters to benefit those that don't have that power?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely part of the action that we can do, is to get close to the issues, is how I often think about it. So if we really want to understand the problems in our communities, then let's get a little bit closer to be able to see for ourselves what's going on, and hear for ourselves what's going on, educate ourselves what's going on. Again, I mean, it goes back to the paying attention thing. Yeah. What are we paying attention to in the world around us? It's this echo chamber thing that we can get caught in, where we just only hear from the same people all the time. But who are we not listening to? Who should be around our tables? All of those things. And I think very much from a church, Salvation Army core perspective, this is important. Who are the people in our communities that are not in our buildings, or not, we don't encounter, but perhaps we should go and just draw a bit closer so that we can hear and see for ourselves, and see what God is doing through that, and how that will lead us into action.
I think that's a perfect place to draw our conversation to a close, because I think it represents what I know of you really well. I think it represents our conversation really well, of the getting up close and doing the work and the listening and the seeing and the hearing and then the living it out. And I hope that people will be encouraged after listening to do some of those things. So thank you so much for your time, Nick.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed this journey of ours together.
Yeah, it's been good. Thank you. I'm so grateful to Nick for joining us. I think he gives us such a clear picture of how deep contemplation and thoughtfulness can result in dynamic action. There's no need to choose between being a thinker or a doer, but allowing both things to inform the other can make a huge impact. I'd love to know what you thought about the conversation, and we've created a space for you to do just that. Why not head to Facebook and search for the All Terrain Conversations and join our group there? It's a space to share the things that have resonated or challenged or the questions raised so we can expand on the wisdom in each episode. I'd love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying these chats, don't forget to hit the follow button wherever you get your podcasts. This will mean that every episode drops straight into your phone, making sure you don't miss out. We'd also love it if you could share the podcast across your social media channels. And if you're listening on Apple, it'd be great if you could give the show a rating or write us a review. All of those things help us get heard by even more people. And like I said at the top, we've still got our sketch notes that accompany each episode, and they can be found either by searching for the All Terrain Podcast or clicking the link in the episode description. I'll be back soon with another guest who will be facing the four choices, answering the four questions, and sharing their wisdom learned along the way on the All Terrain Podcast. So until then, goodbye and thanks for listening.